welcome to Podcast on Fire Network bonus episode on the movie Tracked. And quoted as one of his three masterpieces, Hideo Gosha goes independent and makes 1985's Tracked. And you're listening to a website-exclusive bonus episode only available on podcastonfire.com. And it serves as a bonus to those who followed the series we did on director Hideo Gosha. And if you want additional content after listening to the final episode on the Oil Hell murder, then here we are with a bonus chat on the earlier movie Tracked. And with you is still Kenny B and Robin Gatto. So say hello to the good people again, buddy.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening.
And it's one of those episodes where we're going to go into the topic and subjects quite quickly. So this is the 1985 movie Tracked, and the plot is a very simple one. I took it from Internet Movie Database. A man who is jailed for murdering his family after he confessed escapes. His only chances at freedom is his new love interest that tries to shield him from the authorities. And there is some background to this, which again is available in the written piece that Robin did for Midnight Eye. So I wanted to bring up some info connected to Tracked and where Gosha was in the timeline, so to say, here in the mid-80s. And he was in the phase of being an independent filmmaker. And the first venture into this was this particular movie, Tracked. It was adapted from a novel by Nozomu Nishimura, and it's a true-life crime case it's depicting. It's about a minor-turned-murderer, and it's set 4 years after the end of World War II. And Gosha expressed that he felt a connection to the book and the project. He related to the feelings of his main subject, which he thought was a man deprived of pride, self-esteem, and he was pushed towards darkness and the darkness of his soul. And in the piece, Robin highlight that Tracked was quite a step up, not improvement, but even better qualities was present in Tracked in terms of portraying a man of psychological realism. And even one critic thought it was more unsettling and more unpleasant than another famous serial killer story that was done in 1979 called Vengeance Is Mine, which also stars the lead in Tracked, Ken Ogata. So that's the background I sort of summarized from your piece, Robin. Is there anything else you want to particularly add or talk about in terms of where Gosha was as a person, as a filmmaker, and do you think it's better than Vengeance Is Mine still, this one?
That requires probably a difficult answer. Whether the film is better than Vengeance Is Mine, both films have their qualities, but it's interesting to notice that both films have complex storylines, structures in terms of editing, with many flashbacks in Vengeance Is Mine and flashbacks and flash forwards in Gosha's movie. So I don't know if he knew about that. He probably knew about Vengeance Is Mine. He watched a lot of movies, and so he probably liked the film. I don't know how the novel is structured. I mean, the novel by Nozomu Nishimura, it's a 1980 novel, which was a famous novel. I'm not sure how it's built, so I'm not sure if Gosha changed the structure in during the editing, or if he adapted the novel rather faithfully. I'm not sure about that.
It could work either way, I think, because movies are like this. They have flashbacks and flash forwards, and I don't think it's required to be linear like the book, or not be linear like the book. I think this serial killer genre and story has you have options to do both structures, I think.
In Japan, when you adapt a book, I mean, it's like you have a blood oath with the writer. I mean, Stephen King is okay with changing his books now. He doesn't care that much, you know. He's aged, and so he says, as long as I get money in the films, is okay at the box office. it's okay with me. But if you remember, at the time of Shining, he was really mad at Stanley Kubrick for changing a lot of things about the novel. So in Japan, you have to have the writer's permission. I mean, especially the very famous writers. For example, if you adapt Miyamoto Musashi, I mean, when the in the 50s and 60s, you couldn't change things like that, you know, in the Miyamoto Musashi novels. Mm-hmm. You had to be faithful. And if you change things like Uchida Tomu did, for example, in the 60s with Nakamura Kinosuke, it was okay with the writer. And if you remember when Gosha adapted two novels in 78 and 79, you know, by Ikenami Shotaro, and he made the very, very good Hunter in the Dark, he changed a lot of things, and the writer was mad, and he said openly in the press and in the book that he hated the movies, and he thought Hideo Gosha was a very bad director. So I don't know about the relationship between Nishimura and Gosha. Nishimura was a late bloomer in the field of literature, so maybe he didn't care that much about changing the novel and so on. I'm sure Gosha had a lot of respect for the novel, which was published 5 years ago, and he said he really loved the novel. So I'm pretty sure that he did things right. You know, he didn't want to antagonize the novelist.
It's a serious film and not the film done for just to have some cheap bloodshed on screen. And it's a psychological portrait. So you have to pay attention to what the writer painted in words, I suppose, and it looks like he certainly did. I'm curious about one thing. I believe we talked about it. We said it a few minutes ago. It's an independent film, but Gosha, he went, or his production partners maybe went to different studios to have these movies picked up and presented, because Tract doesn't open with just Gosha Productions. It opens with Shochiku. So was that something he or his producers did after the movies were done, or did they have money from Shochiku while they were making Tract? Do you know of that personally, Robin?
Yes, in the 1980s, what he did was producing the films with his company, Eizo Kyoto, and Shochiku, obviously, when it was Shochiku, or Toei, when it was Toei. I remember at the time of Hitokiri, when he didn't have his production company yet, they split production costs 60%, 40% between Daiei and probably Katsu Productions. So there must be something like that, you know, with Tract. Same with it's Shochiku. So Shochiku, the producers were very good friends of Gosha. They, you know, if you remember the Midnight Eye piece. And I also read about that in other books or articles. He was really saved in his career by Sato Masayuki, who's a Shochiku producer, but who actually ran the Hayuza production company, you know, from the Hayuza Theater. So there was there must have been production cost splits, like, you know, 40%, 30%, something between all the partners. In terms of being independent, it's interesting. I haven't found any article about how he exactly set up his own production company. I guess he'd been thinking about it for years. But, you know, in the past, he would say, he said when he made Hitokiri, for example, he said, well, okay, it's a good film, it's a success, etc. So maybe I should be an independent director now. But he said, I'm still frightened. I feel like coming from television, I'm a farm fish and I have to swim out into the big sea. Mm. So maybe one day. So he had several box office successes with, you know, Onimasa, the Geisha. So now I guess now was the time to set up his own production company and also to be financially involved in the films he was making. He would obviously have some piece of the cake afterwards.
And he was quite busy in the 80s, so obviously this wasn't the only Gosha production production movie. So that begs the question, do you know offhand if there's any information about if Tracht was a box office success, or was it too small of a movie to be big audience appeal?
No, I haven't got any figures. It's difficult to find figures about the movies. I'm still looking for them, actually. So I know about a few films, you know, like The Geisha, like Onimasa. I do have some figures. I don't have any about Tracht. What I read was that it was a success. In the 1980s, you had Onimasa and The Geisha were very big box office hits. I'm not sure Tracht made as much money, but I've read that it was a success. And, you know, Fireflies in the North, which was made right before Tracht, was not a box office success. So it was seen as a cheesy movie, you know. It was a bomb. I mean, he was back on form with Tracht and then Kai Orr. It was more successful, I mean, than Fireflies in the North, for example.
It was nominated for several prestigious awards, though, by the Japanese Academy Awards, including Best Director, Best Actor, Supporting Actor, Actress, but it did not win any awards, according to my research. This was the year when the Academy spread out the awards and gave several movies distinguished awards. You had Ran, movies like Grey Sunset and Love Letter, so maybe at the box office it wasn't easy to battle against the big movies either, but it certainly would have been special if Tracht had beaten Ran. But
yes, in the 1980s, I guess Gosha felt that it was battling against audience-friendly directors making films for young people or women. I think there's an article about that, a funny one to boot, about the Japanese Academy Awards ceremony, where he goes on stage and he feels lonely and isolated as always, and he doesn't win, and so he's looking at his chest and his shirt, and yes, he must have felt like this.
Thankfully, regardless, Gosha had been quite distinguishedly awarded for The Geisha. I don't remember if he won Best Director or if the movie was Best Picture, but it certainly was a big boost, you'd think, to maybe a frail confidence to be awarded. And it's certainly a wise movie to award, The Geisha, as we talked about. It's quite a distinguished movie as well. So let's move on to the movie then, and some we always discuss back and forth, some aspects and things like that, but I'll give you a short opinion first of all, and you can do the same, of course, Robin. And it indeed is a psychological character portrait, so don't expect a fast and furious 2 hours of violence and murders. I think Gosha continues his 1980s confidence here. He is depicting harder, violent characters, but also soft, emotional nature of his characters, which I quite like. And because we have a character that clearly changes somewhat while he's on the run. Gosha, I don't think, is asking us to love the character, because he's committed quite atrocious acts, but I think Gosha quite beautifully and honestly portrays that a character can change, even if a character is a sinner. A character can feel emotions and empathy, and this murderer's time is running out because authorities are trying to catch him. So I think that's very a compelling sort of core to the movie. It's very rewarding, but it's one of those movies that don't decide on it if it's good or not until you've seen the final frame of the film, because I think everything has to be experienced and then think about it. Don't think just because after an hour and you've seen some violence and some drama and some sex that this is the best movie ever. No, wait until some emotions towards the end, and then you can decide. But I really liked it, and it probably is amongst some of his best work, I would think. So that's a little shorter opinion for now. So what do you want to say in short, first of all, Robin, of Tracked, that you've seen a few times over the years?
Yeah, it's a film that has been around in France. In France, I mean, I'm not sure about other countries, but it's a film that was released on tape, videotape, in the 1990s. So it's been around, and it's never been published on DVD or Blu-ray, but it's been around thanks to the efforts of Christopher Gantz and Jean-Pierre Jackson, was a French film distributor. I think a lot of people have heard about the film, but not actually watched it. I'm sure it deserves second viewing now. I think there's a Criterion edition.
Yes, they are streaming it on their Criterion channel, so it's only on streaming. It's not
on streaming.
It's not on DVD or Blu-ray, but they have a Gosha catalog that where most of it is on the channel, and they've only done, I think, two movies on disc: Three Outlaw Samurai and Sword of the Beast. The rest, maybe 5, 6, 7 additional movies that Criterion has, it's only been on the channel, and it's only on the channel.
So it really deserves a DVD edition as well. So I do hope, crossing fingers, that there will be some in the future. But I remember when I met Christopher Gantz, who's a big fan of Gosha Hideo, he said that the film is about Gosha himself. So I said, oh, yeah, you're probably right. It clicks. He, at the time, in 1985, he gave a long interview about the film and his intentions, and he was still struggling with the vision people had of him as a director of, you know, like Chideo Gosha, Blood Gusha, Hideo Blood Gusha, the director of Chambara movies and Blood and stuff. And he was still trying to find his own voice. So he said, I was a director of dirty action movies in the 1960s. In the early 1980s, people see me now as a director of geisha movies, erotic movies, or catfight movies. So I was waiting for the right time to make a film that would be different. So that probably why he worked so much on the structure of the film as well. And so I was waiting for the right time to do a film about human nature. So when he's talking about human nature, you know, he's not talking about, he's not talking about a very audience-friendly movie with very nice people, you know, very nice families. He's always talking about dysfunctional beings and dysfunctional families and dysfunctional couples. I'm sure he remembered how he felt in the early 1980s when he tried to commit suicide himself. You know, in his films, for example, he doesn't film people committing suicide that much. You know, the samurai, the gangsters. I mean, they don't kill themselves, or they walk away. You know, where they're turning their backs on the viewer, on life, they just walk away and disappear. He doesn't like to kill people that much. I mean, kill the protagonist, the main characters. But he likes to show how it would feel if you tried to kill yourself, like in Tracked.
Yeah, that's early image in the movie that and the movie isn't that bloody, even though the 2-3 instances of violence are really terrific, in terms of you'll remember those, and that includes this brutal attempt at suicide, because the character, the Kendo Gata character, then carries a scarf around his neck throughout the movie because he survives it, but he has obviously a very nasty scar. But it's amazing, Robin, that Gosha's touch to violence, it often sticks with you. It's not childish blood spurt. It's powerful stuff. And to see the attempted suicide here is, and to hear he survived as well, because you think, okay, the killer's done his thing, and now we're going to experience the backstory of how we got to this place. No, we're in the middle of the story, essentially, you know.
Yeah. But I guess he just kills himself, even if he fails. And from now on, he will be a different man traveling over Japan and hunted by the police. And, you know, obviously it's a second life. So if you take it in terms of Buddhism, it will be a new chance. And but he's mostly a ghost, a shadow, and a snake, as people say, is crawling through the earth as a snake after he tries to kill himself. You know, having already crawled through the earth, escaping the cell. So it's amazing how, with just very simple makeup, I mean, gray makeup and things like that, Gosha changes the physical nature of the character.
He really, Ken Ogata, despite being simple makeup and obviously glasses and facial hair that he doesn't have in the beginning of the story, I thought he was almost nearly unrecognizable. And I guess that's... you can attribute that to the fact that the character changes to he's not this big character anymore. He needs to be under the radar, and therefore the character, as you said, he's more of a ghost, but he looks weak. He looks a bit nerdy. Maybe character thinks he can be pushed over, that he doesn't have any strength. So that's obviously a man on the run. But also, as we find, so he needs to be that way. But we find out through the movie, in that very compelling drama, that he is changing as a character too. He's not the same man with who took money and is corrupted and is happy to be corrupted anymore. But I'm sure you could see Ken Ogata all the time. But I was struggling when we watched this flashback and the modern day. Is it really the same actor? I mean, he feels so different. And obviously, it's a testament to the performance, obviously, of Ken Ogata, that he feels like two different persons.
In terms of performance with Ken Ogata, you know, you can see him playing that kind of weak and angry characters, you know, in The Ballad of Narayama, in Vengeance is Mine, in another wonderful film by Nomura Yoshitaro, I can't remember the title in English, but Summer of the Demon or something like that. And it's a wonderful film as well about a family, I guess, killing their children. It's very dark, very dark. So when I say wonderful, it's very good, but it's very dark. In terms of, you know, less is more in terms of performance. And so it's very interesting to see how Hideo Gosha uses Ken Ogata. You know, with Nakada, you still have the eyes, you know, doing more than less.
Those eyes are always open.
Yeah, eyes always like saucepans. And Ken Ogata is a minimalistic actor. He feels like a snake in the movie all the time. So it's amazing. But it's what I like about the acting is in fact the way he decides to film a man who is completely deconstructed as a man. And you know, Gosha, he's the director of physical prowess, physical exertion, physical energy. And actually he films Ken Ogata like Izo Okada, Shintaro Katsu, at the end. If you remember the end of Hitokiri, it's the same character in a way, you know. It's Sakane in Tract is a minor, so it's from the lower strata of society. So, I mean, literally under the earth. And in Hitokiri, it's a goshi, so it's a very poor, countrified samurai. So they rise to the top. Izo Okada rises to the top by killing people. And Sakane rises to the top with bribery, killings, and sex, obviously. Not rich, but once they have money, power, they're super gods. And they have the women, and they kill people if they want to. So, and then they're deprived, shorn of everything they had as Superman, and they're nothing. There's nothing left. And I'm sure he wants to deal with the sense of how men, Japanese men, felt after the war during the 1960s, 70s, feeling nothing inside, like there was nothing left of the old world, where you have the, you know, the samurai, the warriors, the idealized men, and there's nothing left except working, toiling away for the reconstruction of the country. I'm sure the two films, Vengeance Is Mine and Usagi Tract, are about the same thing, how men cope with self-loathing and the hollowness they hide. It's mesmerizing to see how through Ken Ogata, yes, Hideo Gosha says something about how he felt and how many men of his generation felt, but especially Gosha also after his divorce, when he was, you know, drinking and he was just lying on the floor and with death in his mind. So it's I always find it very moving to see a director going into his own intimacy, you know, especially someone who's seen as a macho man or a macho director, you know, Sam Peckinpah and that kind of director. And he's really trying to find something very dark in his own soul and putting it on the screen. Well, I'm sure the novel helped anyway. I'm really, yes, mesmerized by the film in terms of its darkness.
And yet it's not an over-the-top nature to it where it's hard to absorb because he's just pushing and pushing. Because Gosha is very good at mixing the soft and the hard, and that's why he has his flashback structure, because we flashback periodically to the character when he's... on the outside anyway, enjoying life because he has money and he can do what he likes. And as you said, if he has the option to kill people, because that's what I'm going to do. And he's going to act on those impulses, which actually leads to some very nice horror beats at the beginning of the movie, where they poke the dirt underneath the floor in his house and they catch a piece of hair on the shovel they're using or the stick that they're using. And those are touches that they are quiet because Gosha is not the director that goes bum or using music to enhance a moment, but it's rather creepy that they just catch a piece of hair and clearly someone is buried underneath the floor, which is a very nice touch. But I really like that As Gosha develops the fact that the new character that he plays, Hay, they refer to him as, that he, yes, he's quiet, he's in the background, he doesn't want to be at the forefront because he is fleeing after all, it's an ongoing case, but still he stands up for certain persons that are pushed over, and he's even encouraging to a degree. He says that you should not be weak and show strength, and next time people won't bully you. So a certain protective nature starts to emerge. But obviously Gosha is very wise to never let us forget that this was a murderer. He might not do it again. He doesn't seem like this nefarious evil character that's gonna commit 10 more murders in the movie, because he's on the run. He can't do that again. And while he's on the run, I think one of my sort of favorite pieces of the movie, and maybe several Gosha movies of the 80s, is that the movie feels realistic. The environments feel very realistic. They're not eye-catching. He's not doing camera shots across the village vistas and tries to establish realism that way. No, Gosha just plants his camera for us to immerse ourselves in that realistic environment, whether it's the mines or whether it's the small bars. Or I don't imagine that's easy, Robin, to get correct the sense of us being immersed in the place in these rural sections of Japan. I don't imagine that's easy. I'm sure these places can exist, but I don't think it's easy just to point your camera and then it's just a few years after World War II when you've done your job. I think you need to have you know, an expert team of designers with you to get this effect of, okay, we're in a we're in a place now. We're in a very different place, and it's it feels you can almost touch that place in a way. And that's something that you either notice or you don't notice because you just watch the story, and that's good enough. But those technical details, and also the developing humanity and drama, and the soft and a little bit of softness in the stories, they're very compelling. So his eye for realism is good to have in a career that's also about stylish movies and stylish costumes and widescreen epics. But I really like that we can have this side of Gosha as well. They're very down to earth and natural, and he doesn't want us to really notice it as such. I think in short, he doesn't seem like a boastful technical director. He knows what he's doing, but he's not a boastful technical director. Like, look at me and all these technical things I can do, and look how pretty it is. I don't know about you, Robin, but I really admire that part of the movie too, that it coexists nice with a dramatic character portrait.
Yes, I think you're right. You would be very pleased. You would have been very pleased with what you're saying now about his mise-en-scène, about his directing style. There's a continuity, you know. There's always I've noticed watching all the films, all of Gosha's films, that there's always a continuity in terms of thematics. I mean, there's a continuity, in terms of themes, in terms of how the male characters interact, how they are portrayed. For instance, if you take the character of Sakane, played by Ogata Ken, and if you take the character played by Takenaka Naoto, you remember I think you talked about him, the character who was being slapped all the time.
Yeah, his colleague at the construction site.
Yes, he's being bullied all the time. And it reminded me of Nakadai and Tanaka Kunie in The Wolves. If you remember the character with Nakadai's Yakuza, you know, the character was crying and saying, it's horrible how the clan's changing and stuff. And then Nakadai say, shut up, don't be like this. And he's almost slapping him. I mean, he likes to portray men like this. It's always a part of his cinema, which is about a relationship between men and how you get to be friendly with another man and how you protect someone else. And it's very Japanese, but it's universal, of course, but it's very Japanese. It's in terms of bonding, you know, men bonding. It's called otoko doshi in Japanese, and you can find this in almost all his films. So as you said, the man is having a second chance, having a second life, is not killing anyone anymore. So he can educate another man in terms of how being tougher. So not like Clint Eastwood. I mean, don't take a gun and start shooting people. No,
there's a balance there. He's not trying to corrupt another person. He's trying to teach him some values to stand up for himself.
And it's also you can find the same scene in the Hitokiri. With, for example, Kasu Shintaro and Mishima Yukio. And this time it's Kasu Shintaro crying over the shoulder of Mishima Yukio, if you remember. Yes, that's the sweetness. That's the sweetness in the films of Hideo Gosha.
And yet it's not warmth that's sweet and cuddly. He combines it with darkness, I suppose, and very dark and complex person. So it's quite fascinating to see the directors do warmth in one way and a director like Gosha do warmth in one way. And both are, of course, good for cinema too. Because I at the core of it all, he never stops to remind us that, oh boy, he's a killer, don't like him, don't feel sympathy for him. But we just feel that Gosha is not saying that we should forgive him for past sins, but he's saying that it's real, it's feasible that a person can create this new character for himself and start to feel more empathy and sympathy for others. But that doesn't mean that by the end of the movie he should get away with his past sins, obviously. And that's difficult, I think, Robin, to ask us to follow this heinous person's full journey.
I think he, with tracks, I think he managed to do something which he failed to do in, I mean, in terms of what he said in interviews. He said in Hitokiri in 1969, I failed to portray the character of Izo Okada as I really wanted to. I mean, in terms of balancing sweetness and ferociousness, the pathetic nature of the man, you know, the violence. And he said in Hitokiri, I wanted to convey the pathetic nature of the character, but maybe people found the character too clownish a little bit.
Yeah, it's a big performance for sure. There are big contrasts between a violent animal and a more pathetic animal. So I think it's more difficult in that movie to get it right.
I guess he's getting it right in Tract. He's trying very hard. The film is quite long, like 2 hours and 14 minutes, something like that. I can't remember if it's 2 hours or 2 minutes or 10 minutes, but it's a long movie. And the problem with the movie, yes, is he's filming a pathetic character with a very limited body language. I mean, it's all about the face, it's all about the eyes, and so it's very difficult to make a movie that lasts 2 hours with that kind of body language. So obviously the technique he used was to deconstruct the narrative, and it's also all the other characters that are looking and talking about Sakane. He does that a lot in all his in his films in the 1980s. I mean, the men are seen by the women and the women are seen by the men. So that's why in Tract, if you remember the geisha, Momowaka, saying enemies are men are enemies of women, obviously that was a message, a personal message, and by Gosha. And in the film Tract, it's men are illusions. Men are maboroshi, which is like ghosts, shadows, illusions.
And it's such a more sad statement versus the geisha, which is more of an angry statement. It's more emotional here, I think.
Exactly.
I think that's the part that got to me the most, that it's not pessimistic and cynical. It's based on your experiences, you can come to a sad conclusion, and you're not a sad, pathetic person if you do so. In this case, the woman, is it Mariko Fuji, who's really wonderful, and I wanted to say that she is a character that makes the new Sakane, she makes him smile and play almost, and he allows for his scar to be seen, which is such a, I love when they show the scar. It's not a complex piece of makeup, but boy, is it a long, black, disgusting, open scar. Really, he really tried to kill himself. So it's not a this faded, slightly reddish scar. Oh, and by the way, before I forget, even though it's a very nicely human and emotional film, my favorite piece is actually amidst the violence, is when Gosha depicts how Sakane kills his wife. We get a physical piece of violence on screen, but it's set to the sounds of the static of the broken radio. So we don't hear screams. We don't hear... Maybe we hear the thump when he smashes whatever implement he uses against his wife's head. I just thought to myself, he's so good at creating different violent scenarios in his movies. It's not artificial. Well, it is artificial movie violence, but it's not common violence. It's not the standard, oh, here we go, lone wolf and cub, blood spurt. It's really a... Maybe realistic is a word, but it really stays with you, Robin, because it feels like that first thump on her head or that second thump on her head, and she's dead right there. She just sinks, and he's essentially angry because she tries to destroy his precious radio, and which sounds funny, but boy, is that a tremendous depiction of violence that's supposed to be devastating, really. So someone's life was taken, and he did it that way. It wasn't planned, but he just did it out of anger, and boom, her life is drained right there and there. Dramatically, really great. Technically, absolutely terrific. And especially, I would want to ask someone who remembers the production when the idea was that we're going to set this scene to the audio of the static that comes out of the broken radio. I would love to know if that was a concept from the beginning, or if that was something they saw in the editing stage as the idea for the scene. So those are the things I'm very fascinated about. But I'm glad it was this choice rather than lots of screaming and, oh my God, what did you do? But rather it's like, great stuff, great stuff.
Are you a sounds man as well?
Yeah, I work in movies. I can do sounds.
About the violence, it's amazing to see the moment when Sakane kills his wife. It feels psychologically real, physically real. It's filmed on camera. It's amazing. I mean, there's even she's even twitching or something when she gets the aches, when she's hacked on her head. You can see some kind of reaction from the actress, which is amazing. It feels very real.
Not even bloody, not even blood going down the face or anything. It's just the body.
So yeah, it's just the body. And Hideo Gosha has always been a wonderful director of scenes depicting violence. I remember, if you remember The Wolves in 1971, that was the most amazing death scene he ever filmed in his career. And that was the death scene of the character played by Kunie Tanaka, you know, with the two female killers in the woods. I guess he was always trying to find something new in terms of how he would film violence.
And you often did with his movies. That's the amazing thing. I mean, and sometimes it was funny and really fun. I remember one brief shot in Violent Streets where someone's face just gets blown off. And I mean, the entire face just collapses. I think someone gets a shotgun shot to the face, and the entire face just disappears. And that's obviously a lot of fun. It's crazy gory, but it's a lot of fun. And that requires technical staging too, obviously. So,
And also, he began, I mean, early on in his career, he would make samurai movies, so he would film long scenes of swordplay. And then in the 1980s, probably, yes, he went on to film domestic violence. As I think I wrote myself, and I can't remember where, you know, it's not the samurai anymore. It's men versus women, and women versus women, and obviously men versus men as well, but it's more contained. It's meant to be, yes, domestic violence or violence in the streets. It's not meant to be like Kinji Fukasaku in the Yakuza movies. It's not that kind of violence. Yes, you know, it's an extension of the relationship between the man and the woman, and how the man feels inside and how the woman feels about the man. And then you boil that into some kind of violence. And how do you film that? So how do you film, for instance, if you remember Kai, made in 1985 as well.
Oh, the same year even, okay.
Yes, if you remember, there's a scene where the husband is coming back to his wife and he wants his daughter back. He catches his wife, he seizes his wife, and then the hair remain in his hands. I mean, his wife's hair, because she doesn't have hair. she doesn't have hair anymore. She's sick.
Right.
And her daughter, the daughter comes back and she takes a knife and she sticks the knife into her father's leg. So that's the kind of violence, I mean, he was filming in the 1980s.
And really, it feels as powerful, if not more powerful. It's all about context, of course. If it's in context within a good movie, and we are on board with the structure. In the case of Tracked, we very much understand the flashback structure that this violence often takes place in. Gorsha is not a director that needs to put cards on the screen 5 years ago, present day, 5 years ago again. The only explanatory cards on the screen on my version are essentially some translation of signs or that were on in a particular mining town. So I really like that Gorsha just flows smoothly between present day and flashback. Granted, Robin, it's not hard to notice when it's a flashback because, one, Ken Ogata looks way different, and if he doesn't have a scarf on his neck, then obviously it's in the flashback because it's before the attempted suicide. But there's a really good balance between the past and the present, so we're reminded again that he didn't make compelling choices, he was an animal. Then we cut back to the fact that characters are willing to protect him, even though they do know almost close to the full picture. It's quite fascinating that that female character is willing to protect this man who is a changed man, but obviously not a sin-free man, and he's never going to be. And that's the sort of not summarizes, but that's the content of the last sections of the movie. Is something going to happen to her if she devotes herself to a man that she knows has murdered people in the past? It's very affecting between them. You talked of her dialogue about that men are just illusions, so maybe that's why she's connecting to him. And it's affecting too that he is obviously connecting to someone, even though there's a chance that he might drag them down, make them accomplices in the case, because she's harboring a criminal, she's hiding a criminal. And all of these things, these emotional confessions and developments takes place in very raw, intimate, and even erotic situations. And yet you don't think of this movie as an erotic movie, necessarily, because Gorsha places dramatic scenes amidst nudity sometimes, which is an interesting choice that you don't think about, like, oh my god, there's sex in this movie, but rather you watch it for the character development.
Yes, it's you said intimate. Yes, that's what I meant in terms of violence. It's meant to be intimate violence and the consequences of the violence. I mean, for a man killing, I mean, there are many cases about men killing their families, I mean, their wives, their children. And how does it feel to live after such devastating crimes? Obviously, I guess Gorsha was trying to convey how he really felt about killing his son, his kid. We don't see him killing his kid, but we understand that he kills his kid. You know, like near a river or a stream, near a wood. And in the movie, if you don't pay attention, there's a moment where he carries a butsudan, you know, a portable shrine. And sometimes, so he takes the butsudan and he does his thing, you know, in terms of praying prayers.
Yeah, he writes his son's name in a piece of
exactly.
Clay, is it?
Yeah, you noticed that.
Yes,
exactly.
What I also noticed, by the way, this is a mild spoiler, when he sets fire to that shrine, I don't think Ken Ogata was ready for the amount of flames that was coming coming right at him. It ignites so quick that it looks like his hair is going to almost burn off from the heat. But
it was a rehearsal for Tokyo Bordello and the fire of the brothel. No, I mean, this is a very important moment, and you noticed it. You nailed it. It's the moment where when he writes the name of his son on the stone for the butsudan, for the portable shrine. And that's, I mean, psychologically, that that is devastating. And that's also the sweetness and the sadness of Gosha's vision.
And no violins on the soundtrack. It's a very just plain situation, but he communicates it very well without being condescending to us as audiences. He even an outside audience who doesn't know that's a shrine necessarily, I think would know that the character of Sakane is finally ready to maybe admit past sins and acknowledge that he did this. Maybe while he's on the run, he's blocked out memories from his past and things like that. So it's a really big moment that doesn't sound big on the soundtrack or visually. So
yes, I guess the melancholy that we have in the film has a lot to do with his personal life as a man, as a director, but it's also about a feeling, an overall feeling of Japanese people. You know, there's I see the some of Gosha's movies as a mixture of traditional mono no aware, you know, the pathos of things. It's meant to be sweet, you know, the mono no aware. It's a traditional concept. It's meant to be longing for the something lost, longing for the past, for the people you lost, but it's and the shortness of life. But Gosha adds violence to that. I like it to think about it in terms of violent mono no aware, which doesn't exist probably. But I mean, Gosha, maybe Gosha would have laughed with such an expression and definition.
But I wanted to ask if this was correct, though. I read that the Japanese title of the movie, if you were to translate that into English, it wouldn't be tracked, as in someone being tracked, but the Japanese title is akin to cosmetics or makeup, which would fit the content and the theme of the movie too. Which is very interesting. I'm sure they contemplated that, well, we can't do that in English. Tracked would probably be better in English. But if that is the Japanese title translation roughly, then I think it's it works for the movie. It means something.
I'm not sure it works the way we think about it. I'm not sure about that, because the translation would be light makeup.
Right.
And so, obviously, we think about Sakane and Ken Ogata applying light makeup on his eyelids or his cheeks, etc. But it doesn't say much about the deeper meaning of the light makeup. So I'd like, if possible, Kenneth, I'd like to have your take on light makeup. How do you see it in relationship with the theme of the movie?
It's very, you know, at least in terms of him, you connect to the fact that obviously he hasn't grown into this character. This is not his natural look, so he obviously has to apply a certain shade, I suppose, which for him is the glasses, the eyebrows, and a little bit of cheek makeup when you see it in the film. But it obviously isn't light makeup. It's him changing into someone completely different. So I mean, it's you when you hear the rough translation, I suppose you think, well, yeah, that's what he did. He couldn't be himself anymore because he would be recognized more easily. But it conjures up images from the film, that's for sure, because we have a scene that combines him putting on his makeup and Mariko Fuji putting on her makeup as well towards the end of the movie. They do cross-cutting between him and her and her and him and so forth. So tracked works well too, because it's the underlying story drive that he is being tracked. We see conventional scenes of a police officer going from town to town trying to follow his tracks, and eventually he starts to catch up. So
yes, sorry, I said eyelids. I'm sorry about that. Don't laugh. It's eyebrows.
Could have been eyelids too. Maybe he was very
it's eyebrows. Sorry, eyebrows. You have to put it in eyebrows. Yes, that's not exactly the meaning. Well, Gosha expressed in a 1985 interview. It's difficult to understand sometimes Japanese psychology. So he said usugesho would be light makeup. So it defines, in terms of social interrelationship, it defines man or woman with light makeup in terms of psychology, in terms of emotions. So it would be a balance between a living with heavy makeup or no makeup. If you live with no makeup, I mean, you might be a very emotional person, very violent person, and you don't fit very well into social the demands of social interrelationship. If you have heavy makeup, you would be a hypocrite. You would be hiding your true feelings all the time to be accepted by people. And if you have light makeup, you would be a person with a balance in life between your true feelings and the facade of and your social face. Basically, he said, I was trying to get past the makeup to get to the true face of the man I was filming. You can do whatever you want with that explanation. But basically, what he wanted to say, that if you have a face with light makeup in life, it means that you don't need to fight that hard anymore. You could have some kind of balance, because it's very difficult to live with no makeup, and it's also very difficult to live with a lot of makeup. So once the character is living with light makeup, is more in tune with who he really maybe wants to be, or I'm not sure about that. It's difficult to understand, but that's the meaning.
But it certainly connects to both the story and certain images in the film, so you as an audience could recognize and think about that. Even though it looks easy, the way he applies makeup, it's a couple of things. For him, it's a heavy thing, because he really is hiding a lot by both the eyebrow makeup and the heavy glasses and the gray hair. So it might not take a long time, but it's a big mask that he puts on for sure. And Gosha does that scene towards the end, where we see him apply all of that. So which is a reason again why you really stop seeing Ken Ogata once he puts on the glasses. Maybe it's all in the glasses, Robin. Maybe that's how he changed completely. Because even when you watch the flashback, yeah, I can see that that's the same actor, but boy, they look different. They really look different one from one another.
He has destroyed his family, has destroyed himself. I mean, in human terms, he's not a man anymore. I mean, he's no one. He's no nothing anymore. I mean, when he's putting on some makeup, he's trying to find the face he's meant to have in society now. He wants to be, obviously, he wants to be recognized as a man, and he will be recognized as a man only through love. So that's a very romantic part of the movie. And Gosha was not shy about saying that he wanted to make a love story. Obviously, he was interested in the violence and the criminal aspects, but it was interesting in having some kind of mixture of romantic love and darkness lurking in every man's heart. So that's how he saw a real person's, obviously, not romantic, but with both darkness and light. And that's the kind of face he wanted to give us, the human face he wanted to portray in the film.
And it certainly comes off that way, in particular in this movie. That balance is very correct and very spot on, I think, and very easy to connect to as well. It's not that difficult to find and interpret that. It's both complex, but it's not hard for us to understand, which is also a balance.
Obviously, he doesn't say much about social violence. He doesn't want to connect the criminal aspects and the criminal psychology to the social surroundings, even though we get to understand a lot of things about the corrupting power of money, about the working conditions, which were horrendous, the miners had no rights, they were like animals. He wanted to portray the journey of a man who evolves out of a social animal being exploited by other animals into some kind of man, the man he could have been in another life, this other life being the life after his suicidal attempt. You know, in the 1980s, Gosha said that he was making films about karma. You get the idea of the second chance. Yes, but it's all about actions. And it's all about, even if you commit murders, it doesn't mean you will be punished. It means that you're still allowed to evolve. So Gosha is not judgmental, never judgmental about the character, about the criminal aspects of the character. He wants to understand, and he wants us to feel empathy with the characters. And I think that's wonderful. That's what's wonderful about Gosha Hideo as a human director.
Yeah, it certainly is that way. I mean, I mentioned a couple of times that he doesn't let us forget that about the past sins, but he's very much open to the idea of, like, he's not closing the chapter on the character. Well, he can't go anywhere now as a person or psychologically, so that's we're done with that now. No, he opens up the book and continues to write the book for that character, because that could happen. But and he's very good at doing that, and also making us believe that those two lives, those two characters, can coexist with each other. One did something incredibly horrendous and wrong, and one is trying to not make up for past sins, but to evolve into a man that wasn't there before. And that is fascinating to watch, even though we obviously do not forgive him for past sins, and we shouldn't. But I mentioned balance a lot of times, but damn it, it's hard to keep those story that storytelling of a character in your head and make it believable on screen. And I mean, that's why I suppose this is one of his top movies, because this is very focused and well conveyed and executed on screen. We're not unsure of what happened, but at the same time, it's not making it easy for us. We have to work during these 2 hours. We have to watch and see big and small moments and see how that adds up to the final the final result of the movie. And I like to work for my Gosha movie, so to say. I'd like to sit there and think. I gladly do, because it's not he's not covering up his thoughts and characterizations in art necessarily, in abstract art or anything. He's very plain and straightforward, but very complex nonetheless, and subtle too. He's not this unsure director who spells it out for us. Again, speaking of the scene with the shrine, that's not necessarily this simple scene to immediately know exactly what's going on, but it's quiet and subtle, so he knows all these things very well, even in this stage of his career. He's not his skill is not diminishing, Robin. That's the fun thing about, he died obviously prematurely being sick, but his skill was not diminishing necessarily. He was just getting better, which is kind of cool.
Especially, yes, in the mid 1980s. And one last thing about the scenario, the script. When he said, when I was writing the script, I was wondering about whether I should kill the woman, whether I should have the character of Sakane kill Chie, the Mariko Fuji character, or if I should have the woman killing the man. So he was trying to find the right ending. And I think he found it. He said, I chose not to have anyone killing anyone anymore. Because he wanted to have a love story, an impossible love story. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want the character to be a criminal until the end, or to be killed because he should be punished. So this is a very emotional movie in terms of how a man does find some form of solace in love, but it's not rewarding, obviously, because he's not allowed to have a second life with the love story that goes on. He has to go to jail now, obviously. So I mean, it's a, in terms of balancing of a balancing act, it's a I think it was the right ending.
And hopefully he didn't, by picking, if he would have picked one of the other endings, hopefully in the end, I hope he pleased the writer, is my point. So because I haven't read the book either, so I don't know if Gorsha did some choices of his own, but we're working with his screenwriter. But I just hope and pray that the writer of the original novel was pleased with what we got in the end. So.
Yeah, it's a very open ending. I'm sure the writer was pleased with the ending.
Do you have any other notes? Otherwise, we'll talk some availability, I suppose.
Oh, yes, there's a funny anecdote.
Sure.
Obviously, you know, every shooting, every production has its funny moments, even if it's about very, very sad things and dark psychology. And so in the scene with Takenaka Naoto, you remember the scene where he breaks the window with his head? Takenaka was a very young actor at the time. I probably was one of his first roles, and he was feeling very, very awkward because he said that's a dramatic role. It's not a comedic role, and I'm a comedian. So I don't know how to play that. So he was, Gosha had to do a lot of takes because Takenaka was like a very young actor, I mean, in terms of experience. But Gosha never forgets details. So he wanted to have the character and the actor to be frightened because it's a very frightened man, obviously, the character in the film. So he said, when you're going to break the window, pay attention, really pay attention to your head because it's real glass. I don't want you to cut yourself. So I'm going to show you, but it's going to be real glass. Okay, so be careful, be ready. And so the actor was real glass. Sorry, what? So yes, it's real. Sorry, it's real glass. I mean, you have to do it for real. What do you think?
This is
It's
filmmaking,
just filmmaking. It's for real. I
kid.
mean, okay. So then he played the scene, and then he dashed towards the window with his head, and he felt nothing. So after the scene, everybody clapped, and Gosha was very pleased and said, "So you did it! See, you did it! It was real glass, and you broke it." And so Takenaka asked everyone, "Was it real glass for real?" And everybody said, "Yeah, it was real glass. Yeah." And then a few years off later, he learned that it was not real glass, but sugar
Of
glass.
course, psychological playtime with the young
Yeah, that
actor.
was psychological playtime, and it must have been very funny on the set.
Yeah, you don't want to sort of think like, well, I can do this. I'll just put my head through there and it will not hurt at all, and we'll go to lunch afterwards. No, that moment needed to mean something, I suppose. And it sounds like an easy psychological game to play, but if it works, and it's not this tyrant doing that, it's a rather correct psychological choice to work with your actors that way.
He was always very playful and but always trying to manipulate people a little bit, but that's what you do on the set. I mean, you have to.
Very cool. Well, on that note, as for availability, this movie, I would to repeat something we said earlier in the show, it wasn't released on DVD or Blu-ray by the Criterion Collection, but it is part of their streaming service, Criterion Channel, which I haven't signed up for it because I don't know if you can sign up for it using PayPal as a payment option and then use the VPN service to actually watch the content. I haven't tried that yet. It used to work that way when Criterion was on Filmstruck. So, but I'll check that out in the future to see if it can work from abroad. But it did had either a Japanese DVD release or a Hong Kong DVD release. But
Hong Kong, yes, yeah.
But it was a nice looking transfer that was on DVD, and that's the version I watched with some custom subtitle in English. They looked a bit more thorough than what you usually get on DVD, so it was a very nice way to watch it. Well, you spoke of that France brought it out at least on tape, but did Christoph Ganz ever bring Tracht to HK Video DVD?
No, never. I've never heard of any plan to release it.
Because sometimes he did like his box sets, and he had different movies in the box sets. They weren't just Samurai Wolf 1 and 2, and sometimes he had very different movies in the same box sets. For some reason, Tracht wasn't part of the plan, I suppose. So.
No, and it's never been part of the plan. I mean, the Samurai movies are much more popular, as you know, as well, than the domestic dramas and the geisha dramas. So obviously it's a very difficult, it's a complex film, very demanding film. Even I guess even for a Japanese audience, you know, it's because Japanese audience, they watch films and they understand everything about the culture in the film. But the structure of Usu Gesho is so complex, I'm sure they were lost, as we were all we're all lost watching the film with so many flashbacks and flash forwards. I'm sure Hideo Gosha wanted to achieve something that was even more complex than Vengeance is Mine, probably. But you know, it in terms of conveying the psychology of the character, you know, everything comes at the end, so it's logical.
For sure. Yeah, you need to sit there for 2 hours and then make up your mind after the final images at the train station, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely.
But it is available officially with English subtitles if you have the Criterion channel. And it seems like they have added their Gotcha catalog sort of immediately. The channel is only a few months old at the time of recording, but they haven't gradually added the Japanese catalog. It seems like they just threw it all on there, and you can watch Hunter in the Dark and Tracht and of course the Three Outlaw Samurai and go back to those movies as well. So it's nice that it's available in English for English speakers and those in need of English subtitles. So you would only hope that there would be more movies, but we're very happy for what's on there, regardless if it's English subtitled or not, because France have been kind to Gosha in that regard, whether HK Video or Wildside Video being behind it. So that's why we like France on this show, because they love they love Jerry Lee Lewis, they love Choi Hak, and they love Hideo Gosha.
Oh yes, obviously they do. Yes, Jerry Lewis. Jerry Lewis, yes, right.
Yeah, and then for Hong Kong fans, they love Choi Hak. Some of the best DVD editions of Choi Hak movies are from Christoph Ganz, whether it's Shanghai Blues or Dangerous Encounter, First Kind, those dark movies. So that's what I love about France. They like movies. Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody for listening to the bonus episode discussion, a little additional content, but I wanted to include Tracht in some shape or form, and I'm very glad that we got a chance to talk about it, Robin. So thank everybody for listening to us on the website only, and for supporting the series on Hideo Gosha. I have plenty more movies to watch because I haven't seen all of them in this coverage. I needed to pick and choose, so I haven't seen The Story of the Urn or some of the other gangster movies. I haven't seen all of the 80s movies. I haven't seen Or or Five Flies of the North, etc. I've not seen Hunter in the Dark, so I still have things to gaps to fill in, but I certainly can if I want to. But I am, regardless, Kennedy, and with me for this bonus episode was the author and writer Robin Gatto. So thank you very much, Robin.
And thank you very much, Kenneth.